Hey everybody, welcome to Bod's Mayhem. I am your host, John the Bod, aka the Bod Father. And as always, I'm bringing you guys awesome interviews. And today, it's a privilege and an honor to have this man on our radio show today. He's actually the former vocalist of the iconic band Black Flag from 81 to 86. He's also a writer, journalist, publisher, actor, television and radio host. He's done the spoken word. He's in all kinds of things, and plus, he hosts a weekly radio show on KCRW. He's none other than Mr. Henry Rollins himself. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm good, man. How are you?
Doing awesome. Glad you could take time out to do this show, and been a big supporter of you ever since I found out about Black Flag and everything, so thank you for doing this.
Oh, no problem, man. Thank you.
Black Flag is one of the most iconic hardcore punk bands out there, but at the time when you were a part of it, how much did music need a band like Black Flag back in the day?
How much did music need a band like Black Flag?
Yes.
I don't know if music ever needed the band Black Flag specifically, but basically, to quote a paraphrase, Spinal Tap, bands like ours, our genre, if you will, I think you can't say they're necessarily important, but I think we were helpful. And I say, when I say we, I'm talking about a whole bunch of bands. In shaking things up, and I think in music, every once in a while, some bands have to come in and kind of flip the script and wreck the place so everyone kind of snaps out of their stupor. And I think punk rock, the first wave of punk rock in England, did that very effectively. Because a lot of the arena bands, there's these sleep-inducing 40-minute drum solos, and all of a sudden here comes the Sex Pistols and the Clash, yep. And rock and roll was alive again. Here's the Ramones, and all of a sudden you can get excited about going to see a show rather than wanting to take a downer and kind of cruise through it, drooling onto your corduroy jeans. And I think in America, young people needed a reason for their parents to fear rock and roll again. And I think Black Flag and the Bad Brains and Minor Threat and on and on and on, bands like that, gave music some excitement, gave authority a good wake-up call, and gave radio and what would be MTV a little poke in the ribs. I think it was all around a good thing. Black Flag specifically, I can't really speak to, but I think overall, those bands were very instrumental in bringing about more good bands and maybe kind of changing the way people think about radio and making and buying records.
Back in the day like that, it was so much therapy for young kids, as it is today for kids.
Absolutely.
You know,
when I was young, I bet I'm older than you, but when I was young, bands were so mythological. They were so huge. And maybe that's just, my experience growing up where I did. But I would go see Led Zeppelin and saw Ted Nugent and Van Halen and Aerosmith and bands like that. And it was all great. I mean, those were amazing shows. But being in a band yourself seems so unattainable just because you're never going to be Led Zeppelin.
Right.
So why would you even have musical aspirations? And quite often in those days, music at school was a trombone lesson or piano lessons, and it just didn't seem appetizing for someone who's young and angry who wants to, plug in something and really let it rip. And within one summer, 78, 79, all my friends were in bands. Like, we all kind of dropped our Stingray bikes for skateboards and then kind of transitioned to skateboards to skateboarding to band practice. And my best friend, Ian Mackay, we grew up together since we were very young, and all of a sudden he's in some band. So I guess I'm going to band practice to kick it with my friend Ian and his bandmates who I met. I became like the fifth member of the band in that I would carry the gear from the car trunk into the venue. And all of a sudden, so much becomes possible. And this was the first ever Discord band, Teen Idols. And all of a sudden they're in the studio. We all walked into the studio together for the first time. We all looked around like, wow, a recording studio. And then they made a record. And all of a sudden, all these things you never thought possible, not only were they possible, you're doing them. And to actualize all of that, You know, and I think that might be the most valuable part of this kind of music, was to show, you know, some kid in the Midwest or what, way up in, you know, North Dakota, where there's like nothing around him, that they can buy cheap gear, go into a garage, and raise total hell, and really express themselves. That you don't have to be David Bowie or Jimmy Page. You can just be the guy from this town. With, you don't even have to have a song. You just have to want to hit it. And I think the power of that cannot be over mentioned.
Yeah. And you know, too, music is so much therapy for people that's being bullied. They can get stuff out on paper that they can put out there, you know, and things like that. And it's so awesome how music can touch people, man.
Yeah, it's the best. You know, my mom raised me pretty much. I see my mom 5 days a week, and quite often I see my father 2 days a week, just because the divorce agreement, you know, typical American upbringing.
Right.
But my mom's apartments that we lived in Washington, D.C., she would kind of apartment hop every few years, we'd move. It was always like small places, but the walls were lined with LPs and books. We rarely watched TV, read a lot of books, but the record player, man, the record player was rarely not on. And I would go to the record store with my mom up to three nights a week, because there was one really good one right across the street from where we lived. And if I even looked at a record, my mom would go, put it on the stack. If I showed the most remote interest in a record, she'd go, okay, because they're cheap.
Yep.
And I'd listen to her records. Like, she'd have, you know, some classical music on. I'd go, wow, that sounds good. She'd take it. I'll buy another. Because when you have a record player like my little General Electric, you know, one with the little suitcase speakers and everything with a handle on the top so you could carry it, it's going to do damage to a good record. So she knows she's not going to lend it to me and get it back in any real way she can use it again. So you're like, take it, and she'd get another. And by the time I was in fifth grade, I was into Jimi Hendrix and The Doors and Isaac Hayes, and like Broadway musical soundtracks, just because I would hear it. And my records were way better friends to me than the friends I made in school. You know, because the kids at school throw a ball at your head, they tease you.
Yeah.
You know, hey, Spaz, you know, whatever. But the Beatles, they never made fun of you. They never tried to fight you. You know, they just made nice songs, and they looked friendly, so you could put their records on and listen to them and not feel so alone in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm almost 54, man. And I listen to music every day, or I don't know what would happen to me. I mean, literally, I don't know a day that goes by where I haven't listened to half an hour to 5 hours of music.
Yeah.
I need it. Like, I need air.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing has ever been better for me as far as the best I ever feel. Like, where all is all right with the world is either when I'm working and I'm just kind of in it, or if I'm not working, if I'm just playing music, or both, you know, writing and with the music on. And music has been, since I was, my earliest memories, has been like pretty much the best thing I've ever found.
Now, for you, when you hear people say that, you know, when you were a part of Black Flag, and they come to you or email you and you say, hey, look, man, you guys made a total impact on us. What's that mean to you?
Well, I'm just glad that music was able to impact someone rather than heroin or crime. So, you know, I get those letters quite a bit. Hey, you know, I haven't been listening to you since, you know, insert the year, and thanks for your music or whatever. And I just say, hey, you know, thanks. Thanks for listening, and I'm glad it was useful. And that's the word I always use.
Mm.
You know, hey, that book you wrote got me through high school. Well, I'm glad the writing was useful, because it is useful. Like, those records are your friends. You might not meet the guy in the band, nor do I think it's all that important to meet, you know, your favorite band, because, you know, they might be some unsavory individuals. You might regret that. But they made a record that helped you, you know, realize yourself or get over the blues or give you some grist for your mill or whatever it is. And so I'm just glad that I provided a soundtrack. And in Black Flag, that's what we always called ourselves. We always said we're a soundtrack. We're the soundtrack for whatever you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So don't forget about us. Like, at the show, don't need to look at us. We're just here, you know, we're rendering the music. It's not as much a performance. We're just kind of supplying this thing for your movie. So you do your thing, and don't throw any ashtrays at our head while we do ours. And so useful is for me the operative word. And I appreciate those letters, but mainly I'm just thankful that we were able to be useful.
Now, I know that you guys have played a lot of places and everything like that, but for you, and you played overseas, but for you, what was your most memorable show that stuck out in your mind?
Of every show I've ever done?
What's your most memorable show?
I've done over 3,000 shows. That's a good question. In that there's been, in that line of work, and ask anyone, and I'm sure you've talked to a ton of people in bands.
Oh, yeah.
There are high points, and there are low points. And it doesn't matter if you are a bar band or the Rolling Stones. You will experience what they call the vicissitudes. In that, some days are great, and some days you must kill the bass player. And it's just a long day. And some nights, you know, the electricity goes out on stage. So, and it's just a nightmare. Mm-hmm. I can't really point to a single most memorable show, but I will say that I think some of the best shows I ever did in my life were at CBGB's.
Nice.
I just think there's something about CB's where you'd be two-thirds of the way into the show. You're, like, really in it. You've passed, like, the two songs of catching your breath and regulating your heart rate. You are really in the middle of it where you don't remember when it started and you don't know when it's going to end. And it occurs to you that this is one of those nights of your life, that this is not only a really good show, but this is just one of those very meaningful nights. And you look at the audience and you can't really distinguish yourself from them because everyone is so collectively in the moment of it. And I've experienced that a few times in my life, and at least two or three of those times were at CB's. And I don't believe in magic or anything spiritual, mm-hmm. but there was something about that place. Also, you know, there's something about being in a band and playing so hard so often and living for the music so completely that you have shows that are hyper-real. They are more real than real. It's why some people can't get off stage. It's why you see some ancient guy still out there, because it's such a thing.
Yeah.
But as far as, you know, like greatest shows, I just remember, you know, great instances of things happening. Like I did a show in South America once in Brazil where I knocked myself out and I thought someone else hit me.
Oh, wow.
My head came down and my knee went up and I split my right eyebrow open over the skull tissue over my eye. And if you hit something, if you hit it hard, like you see boxers get it, where they just kind of explode open.
Right.
And it bleeds magnificently, yet they're not really that hurt.
Yeah.
And there's really no pain, but it looks amazing. It looks like it's, you know, CGI.
Yeah.
I did that in Brazil, the first opening seconds of a song. I hadn't even sung yet. And the band and myself, we arrive on stage, like, you know, 20,000 people. It's a festival. There's certainly no way we could have ever drawn that amount of people. And the band comes crashing in, and within 10 seconds, the singer is laid out on his back, twitching in a puddle of blood.
Oh, my God.
And that was me. And I got up, looking around, like, okay, who hit me? Because I've been attacked and beat up before on stage, so there's nothing new. I was like, okay, where is he? And I feel my knee, and they hit. I understand. I'm like, oh, that was me. And the audience is looking at me like they're watching a movie. And I look behind me at the band as my head is still clearing. And they're looking at me like, who is this idiot? And then I look down on the stage, and it's just so much blood. And you know, we flew all the way down to Brazil to play a show. So we just, you know, we played. And with a headshot like that, I play very, you know, with a lot of emphasis. And so it keeps the blood pumping out of the wound. So I bled magnificently and heroically for the better part of an hour. And it never really stopped. It just kind of kept coming out. And by turning my, you know, thrashing my head around, I covered the drummer in blood.
Jeez.
I covered the rented drum gear in blood, the monitors, the stage. And then good old Evan Tendo has to come out after us and stand in my blood and sing his wonderful pop songs. And it's nights like that where it's thankful. If you can look at it the right way,
yeah,
it's funny while it's happening, not to mention a day later. I mean, it's hysterically funny. Thankfully, I was the only one who got hurt. But even as you're doing, you're like, really? It's so not flipping burgers. And you realize I have chosen a very interesting path in life.
That's very true. Very true. Now, your first book, correct me if I'm wrong, was Black Coffee Blues. Is that correct?
Not my first one, but an early one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So what was it for you, man, that made you want to do short stories and plus your journal entries and put it out there for people?
A couple of things. First off, I'm that kind of person. I want to be on stage. I want you to hear me. You know, I'm that kind of person. We're not hard to find.
Right.
And I was living a very interesting life on the road. Mm-hmm. Like, I go from, 50-hour-a-week minimum wage work in Washington, D.C., to being the singer in this band. And you're playing one night, and you look out in the audience like, whoa, that guy just stabbed that guy.
Wow.
And tomorrow, there's a religious group protesting our show, saying that we're in league with Satan. And there's an undercover cop. I mean, it was really eventful. And you're hearing things. You know, people say, hey, my girlfriend just did this, and I beat her up, and I got to go to court. You're like, whoa. I mean, you're just hearing this, like, insane stuff around you. It would make a pretty good book.
Yeah.
And at one point, someone loaned me a copy of Henry Miller's great book, Black Spring, which I'd never read writing like that before. He's a genius. I mean, he just wrote about life. And you read, you're like, you can do that? I mean, you can say that in a sentence. I never knew. And I stupidly thought that since he was so plain talking, that I could write as well. And when you really try and write, especially if you don't really have it, because I don't have it, I have to really force myself, you realize how good he is and how easy writing isn't. And so I said, I'm going to be like Henry Miller. I'm just going to put it out there. And then I started really working at writing, like really going for it. Like every day I'm going to sit down and write. And I really forced myself to get better at it. It's like, you know, doing push-ups.
Right.
You know, first day you can do 4. But if you work at it, you'll get to 50.
Right.
And I just said, you know, and when you're living that kind of life, you have no money. And so the afternoons are long in that you pull into some crap bar to play at 3 in the afternoon. There's nothing for you until like 9 p.m. And you can't buy anything. So you just walk around and listen and look. But if you have a journal that costs $2 from a drugstore, you have a place to go. You have a place to go beat up the bass player. You know, you just write about it. You just, you know, can whine and whatever. And, oh, I'm lonely and whatever you want to write without having to, because Black Flag, there's no one you're going to talk to and say, I feel lonely, and have them say anything less than, you know, suck it up, Caroline. I mean, no one, there's no sympathy in that band. And so I would just turn to my journal, and it became quite the refuge, and I really started seeing the power of words. And being the exhibitionist, assaultive type, I said, well, I'll put out a book. That's what I'll do. And having a good understanding of the DIY world from watching Ian MacKay form Discord Records and living and working at SST Records with Black Flag, I just saved my food money for quite a while and made a printable version of a fold and staple fanzine, basically, marched it up to a printing place where Black Flag got its printer, flyers made. I said, make me 500 of this. And I used Raymond Pettibone, the great Black Flag artist. I borrowed his stapler and some of his father's staples, and I collated, folded, and stapled my first 500 of my first little book. And I sold them for $2. And out of 500, I probably gave away about 490 of them and sold a few and lost the rest. And from that, made enough money to print it again. And from that, made a paperback with real binding. Reprinted that as I wrote the next one. And that was 1982 going into 1983. And 30-some years later, it's now a fully staffed publishing company with, you know, print runs and pressings in different languages and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I write then for the same reasons I write now, is to, you know, put something across, to communicate. to basically, you know, howl at the moon.
What book would you suggest from you for someone to start to reading on if they wanted to get into your books?
Well, if I was ever to suggest a book of mine, it's, you know, I like you. How could I ever suggest one of my books? Like, as your kind of friend, why would I do that to you? And so I would recommend other people's books first. Like, if you just wanted to pick up a great book and read it, I would pick up John Fante, F-A-N-T-E, a great book of his called Ask the Dust. It's just one of the finest works in American literature, I think. Mm-hmm. It's a quick read, but it's like going four rounds with a professional fighter. I mean, you will feel it by the end of the book. As far as books of mine, I've been told, because I kind of write them one after another and throw them over my shoulder and write the next one, so I don't really know if they're any good, but the letters I get a lot, people like the new one called The Grim Detail. It's travel stories of me all over the world in 2009 and 10. They like a book I did called Solipsist, and they like a book of mine called Get in the Van, and they like Black Coffee Blues. Those are the ones I'd probably get the most mail about. Mm-hmm. Although I am happy to report that, at least from the emails I get, people do seem to like the new one, which is encouraging.
So writing for you has been a big relief for you coming up to this point.
Yeah, absolutely. I do it every day. My rule is I try and squeeze 1,000 words out of myself a day.
Nice.
Even if it's about nothing, even if it's just 1,000-word complaint about whatever it is, I just try and mechanically apply myself, brain to the paper, every day or night for at least 2.5 hours.
Now, you've been in some really cool movies and shows, you know, such as your own show that you had, The Henry Rollins Show, plus Uncut from New York City, plus Up For It, plus Jack Frost, which I really like your character in that one, the crazy parent hockey coach.
Oh, yeah.
And plus, you actually done one of my favorite shows on the History Channel, 10 Things You Don't Know About.
Oh, thank you, man. Yeah, I appreciate that. Thanks for checking it out. I've done a lot of TV and film in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never worked so hard on one show as I worked on the 10 Things show.
Yeah.
Just the nature of it. It was just a lot of travel, a lot of study, and some very long shoot days. And we would do 6 days a week shooting. And the last season was about 5.5 months of work, pretty much full on, where by the end of it, me and the EP and the production manager and the production assistants and our camera guys, we were just, you know, pretty flattened out.
You covered one of my favorite things, Abraham Lincoln plus Civil War stuff. That is my passion right there.
Yeah, that's a fascinating part of American history.
Oh, man. That's like my alley right there 1,000 times more.
Yeah, Lincoln, you know, if I had more time in a day, I mean, and it is at a certain point, you just realize you're not going to get it all done just because of that, you know, that pesky mortality. But I would, if I had more time, I would definitely be a Lincoln scholar, and I try and read a little Lincoln pretty often, you know, like his speeches.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them I just read again, just because the guy really knew how to write a sentence. And Lincoln, on my best days, I am Lincoln-esque. You know, like when you read him, you go, wow, this guy's really fair, or at least he's trying to be. Like, he might not be a nice guy, but he's writing nice stuff. I mean, I don't know. I never met him, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But when you read his writing, he is so immediately and extraordinarily fair,
mm-hmm.
brilliant, and strange at the same time. I mean, he was a weird dude, a weird sense of humor, but an unnatural grip on the English language. I mean, maybe, as far as a writer, maybe our greatest president in a literary sense, as far as like sitting down and writing something, like the Gettysburg Address, or one of his early speeches, the one from 1838, the speech to the Young Men's Lyceum from January of 1838. He was very young when he wrote it. It was the first time he ever brought up the topic of slavery in public speaking, and it's a magnificent speech. I mean, you can just like download it right now off the internet. It's like 3,500 words or something, and it's just, every damn word of it is just extraordinary.
How was standing in Ford's Theater, man? Was it kind of an eerie?
Well, just so you know, I come from Washington, D.C.
Right, right.
And during the week, when the tourists aren't around, that is a fully functioning theater. And so as a school person, schoolboy in D.C., you are brought there, you know, third grade, seventh grade, tenth grade. Here's, you know, and so for theater, I saw Godspell there, Jesus Christ Superstar. I saw comedies. I mean, I went with my mom and sat in those seats and watched plays on that stage, like it's just a theater. But you would look up to basically your 1 o'clock to the president's box and remember, you know, knowing from your history what happened there.
Yeah.
But being there, like when you saw me on the TV show, we got there like 6 in the morning. We had Ford Theater to ourselves.
Jeez.
That was heavy. I mean, there was nobody in there but security, film crew, and one of our guests. And I sat in a seat as close as you can get to the president's box, which is basically to the, if you're sitting there, it's be to the to Lincoln's left. And so I just sat there where you can kind of, you know, look over to your right and kind of see it in a way. But the closest I've ever gotten to it, but perhaps the heaviest experience, and we had to get special permission from the staff, but they allowed us to do it. I was allowed to walk out of, for the benefit of the camera, it's in the show, the same doorway that Booth walked out of, well, limped out of.
Wow.
And that was heavy.
Yeah.
As a little bit of arcane history, on the other side of those doors is an alley. And there's a very popular club in Washington, D.C., called the 930 Club. It's still around, but in a different building. But the original 930 Club is where many of us, you know, saw shows that changed our lives and played shows that changed our lives. But that alley that you load in, you drive down this alley and you load in to the 930 Club. As you're loading in, you're looking at the door Booth ran out. The alley you drive down is the alley Booth ran up.
Hmm.
And whenever, you know, I'd be there, some band is loading in. I remember I helped Black Flag load in for their D.C. show before I was in the band.
Yeah.
And I said, see that door? John Wilkes Booth came out of that door. That's Ford Theater. He ran right past your van and up that alley. And like I've said that to more than one band.
Right.
And they're like, everyone stops. You're like, really? And you're like, yeah. And I was in that, I hadn't been down there for 20 years when I shot that show summer before last. And I told the director, I said, you know, this is a landmark right here. And he said, talk about that. And I said, okay. And it's a fascinating bit of history, you know, just having, you know, growing up in D.C. was amazing because it's a small town. It's not that hard to navigate on a pedal bike. And you can, on your skateboard, go from your home past the Watergate Hotel, Nixon and all that stuff, and then, you know, not so far later, be skating past the White House or Ford Theater. I mean, it's all really immediate. And when you grow up in that town, all that stuff becomes kind of part of your story as well, if you want it to be.
Right.
And I used to go to that Howard Johnson's where the plumbers had that meeting before they broke in, you know, the whole Watergate thing.
Yeah.
That was just a, you know, a diner. I used to go in there on dates thinking, yeah, gee, Gordon Liddy was in here once. But yeah, the whole era of Civil War, era America, and 1865 to me is very relevant to where we are now.
Mm-hmm.
1865, as you know, the war came to an end. We got the 13th Amendment. And we were, we Americans had a chance to right the wrongs of slavery and racism and bigotry and move on. And we, you know, we failed.
Yeah.
I would, in my opinion, I regret to say, I think we failed that mission.
Mm-hmm.
I think we had a chance, but I don't think Reconstruction did what it needed to do. Instead, we got Jim Crow laws. Instead, we got institutionalized racism. And so that time period, I'm fascinated like I'm looking at a car wreck. I don't want to look, but I can't turn away.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you guys covered it because, like I said, I'm a huge history buff when it comes to Civil War and things like that. And I'm glad you guys paid it justice, honestly.
Yeah, so, I tried. I'm sure you've spent your time with the Ken Burns multi-hour Civil War documentary.
Yeah.
It's tough. I mean, it's hard to look at, and it's a lot of information, and it's kind of hard to get those reports of all that carnage.
It is.
Like, in 20 minutes, there's this many dead. You're like, oh, come on, man. Because
yeah.
I don't want to kill anyone in Tennessee. Yeah. You know what I mean? I don't want to kill any American.
Right.
And when you see what we did to each other, it's just heartbreaking.
It is. It takes me back, and I'm watching it, and plus when I was going through school and going through it, it's like, we really did that to each other? I mean,
yeah.
Really?
No, it's unbelievable.
How was Sons of Anarchy for you? I got a lot of people wanting me to ask you that. How was working on the set of that?
It was, as far as scripted, you know, like acting, it was probably the best environment I've ever been in. I was sitting right in this seat that I'm talking to you from now, and my manager calls, like 2008 or 9, whatever it was, and he said, Kurt Sutter, you know who that is? I go, yeah, of course, it's the guy from The Shield and Sons of Anarchy. He's a genius. But I think The Shield was one of the best things ever done to TV, and he was all over that thing, acting, directing, producing,
yeah,
writing. And I said, yeah, Kurt Sutter, why are you mentioning him to me? He goes, he wants to meet you. And, you know, I'm glad I was sitting. And I said, about what? He goes, I don't know, but you're going, because your meeting's in 20 minutes. Go. Here's the address. And he's about four traffic lights from where I'm sitting. So I jam over there, and I walk in. It's a big production house. It's where they do all the interiors on Sons of Anarchy. It's where they have the jail and the clubhouse and all of that. And I walk in, and this really cool reception. He goes, hey, Henry, cool. Kurt's office is down the hall. He's, you know, go on in there. It's like really casual. I'm like, okay. I walk in, and there's Kurt Sutter with all his tattoos and everything. He's like, hey, Henry, I'm Kurt. Big fan. I'm like, okay. This is, you know, kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah.
And he goes, you know what I do? I go, oh, yeah, man, I'm all over you like a chief suit. Yeah, I'm, you know, chapter and verse. So he said, well, we're starting to write the new season of the show, and we have this idea. And he starts laying out for me this character. And we... For about a solid hour, we talked about white power groups and people who are sociopaths and psychopaths, you know, who will take an order to go kill someone and think nothing of it, and all of that, if you will. So he said, so what do you think about this character? I go, well, I don't know, sounds like a pretty dangerous guy. And I'm sounding a bit naive, but I am kind of that naive. I go, so why are we talking about all this? And he said, well, I want to know if you want to be that guy. And I was so dumbfounded. I go, what, like in the show? He said, yeah. I said, well, yeah. When do I audition? He goes, that was your audition. I know you can do it. I'm just brought you here to gauge your interest. I said, oh, well, I'm beyond interested. He said, good, you have the job. So don't say anything until you see the press release. So I'll see you at the barbecue before we start working. I said, really? He said, yeah. I just kind of stumbled out of his office fairly numb, drove back to here with the phone ringing off the hook because of the manager who's thinking of his 15%.
Yeah.
And he said, well, I said, I think I have a job. Why don't you, you know, call his people and, like, confirm that? Because I'm still kind of in disbelief because for a guy like me, nothing comes that easy. And he made some calls. He goes, yeah, you're in. And, you know, I'm good at keeping secrets. So I knew... The woman who runs my office knew, management, and my press agent. And we just, you know, didn't say anything. And then months later, all of a sudden, I get like 80 emails in 1 hour. Dude, you're in Sons of Anarchy! Which obviously the press release had gone out, and that was the case. And suddenly, I'm on the set. Well, we had a big cookout, you know, welcome to day one. And, you know, they're in season two. You know, they're already dialed in. Like, the gang, they're all friends.
Yeah.
They've bonded. They're all in, you know, they're all tight buddies. And here I am playing this, like, white power racist skinhead asshole. And I'm new on the team. And, you know, actors can be pretty mean. You know, they can keep you kind of shut out, especially if you're joining on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, well, okay, you know, I'm the Auslander. What's this going to be like? And then... Every single cast member of Sons of Anarchy came up to me one after another. Henry, I am so glad you're here. This is going to be so awesome. Anything you need, let me know.
Wow.
All of them did that. I was like, wow. Like, all of them, down to Katie Seagal. Just like, so glad you're here. Anything you need. This is going to rock. I'm like, okay. And like, I don't think they could have been more friendly. I think it would have been impossible. And so for 6 months, I basically just acted my ass off.
Yeah.
You know, got beat up by Charlie all the time for 3 hours at a time. It's amazing how long those scenes take to shoot.
I can imagine.
And how many times you can throw yourself into a police car and not crack a rib.
Jeez.
And so you're in an environment where everyone is insanely talented, friendly, and to top it off, everyone's funny. Like after every take, someone's making a joke, usually Perlman.
Yeah.
And it was, I had a lump in my throat the day I rapped. And we, you know, as you know, you often shoot out of sequence.
Yeah.
And we killed me on one day, and then the next day I had to go in there with B camera and do some walking in and out of a building, like no voice, just walking in and out of the building and getting into my truck. Just like, you know, just one of those like 2 hours of walking and getting into a truck and you're done. Mm-hmm. And that was my last day without all the other actors, just me and a small camera team. And, like, you know, no makeup person, no, you know, there's, like, nobody there, really. There's, like, you know, five of us. And that was it. Okay, Henry, thanks. Goodbye. And I drove home really missing it and really being not jealous because they earned their success, but really kind of admiring the rest of that cast, knowing that the next 5 years of their life was just going to be stratosphere, you know, that this show is going to be huge.
Yeah.
And I'm obviously dead, and I'm not going to have any part in it, but they were, and how much I wish I had one of their jobs. And it was just a really good time, but I left that set for the last time with a very heavy heart. I really missed it as soon as I got back to the office.
Now this goes back to like music and everything, you know.
Sure.
Especially for today. Since it's the digital age, do you think social media has helped out bands to get their music out there more, better than it has, you know, in the past of the do-it-yourself, of flyers, posters, word of mouth, stuff like that?
Yeah. Yeah, there's upsides and downsides. I think the up outweighs and eclipses the down, in that the downside, a woman who bosses me around at this office, she went online one day. And after a couple of hours of work, she came into my office. She said, okay, I just went and did this all myself. But just so you know, I can download every album, spoken word and music, and every DVD you've ever done for free, just so you know that. I mean, if someone wants, they can kind of hear everything for free. How do you feel about that? And I said, well, are you angry? Do we do something? I said, no. And I've been saying this for many years. That's what I said to her. I come from punk rock, where you know you basically get a punch in the mouth and thank you very much. And sometimes you don't even get the thank you very much.
Yeah.
I'd rather be heard than paid, because I'm just more used to getting hurt than paid. And so I'm not gonna be like the guy in Metallica who, you know, runs after the kid for his 35 cents.
Yeah.
And I'm not putting Lars down. I'm just saying I don't care if some youth downloads my record and doesn't pay me. I care because my bandmates could get some money. And that, you know, some of them got kids, and that kind of bugs me. And that, you know, I'd like for my friend with two kids to get an income from his very good and hard work. For myself, yeah, I don't care. But on the other hand, the fact that this person had access to the music so easily, or if they have a Spotify account or one of those accounts where you can just, you know, join on or whatever, and all of a sudden have, you know, 10 million miles of music to wander around through, I think that could very well inspire a young person. And if you notice, I never talk about old people like me. It could inspire a young person to take a chance spending an hour listening to John Coltrane.
Yeah.
Or Beethoven. Or I read this interview with Henry Rollins, and all he did was talk about the Velvet Underground and the Stooges and television and Mott the Hoople.
And the Damned.
Click, and all of a sudden, that person is like, wow, I really like this music.
Yeah.
And it was nothing but a point and a click. Like within seconds, their curiosity is being satiated and gratified. and inspired to become more curious. And if you can get that for like $30 a month for the rest of your life, that part I think can save the world.
A lot of the bands that I like, I have to get digipacks because I live in Kentucky, the eastern part of Kentucky, and we don't get a lot of those albums into our areas, and it sucks, man.
As you know, in Kentucky, there's a lot of things you don't get enough of.
Yeah, that's true.
But one thing you do seem to get a lot of is exploding growth in prison population. Congratulations, Kentucky. But as far as music, in America, there's pockets of America where there's no record store. You know, there's not some cool, hip place where some guy's buying from small labels and he's got that new thing. And, you know, if you listen to metal or like death metal, stoner music, some of these records, man, they're made by the bands at home from their own company, you know, Color Xerox, CDR. I mean, I'd buy records like that almost every day from labels that are so small you can lose them under your napkin.
Yeah.
And there's no record source for records like that, or maybe there's one or two, but there's not 10. And thanks to the internet, I've connected with so much music. Man, I'd never be able to thank the internet enough. You know, I go online looking for stuff literally every day, just something cool to listen to. Or someone will say, hey, Henry, man, I saw this band of South by Southwest, check them out. So you check them out, and all of a sudden you're like, damn, I'll buy that record.
Yeah.
Where are they at? And you go check out the whole record online for free, which I do, and I go right to the store or the mail order, and I buy it. But quite often next to the video of the album on YouTube, there's some other band. Like, that has an interesting name. Click on that. Damn, I'm buying that record, too. Yeah. I'm that guy. You play me one good band and suggest some others, I might very well buy all of it. I'm on a see music diet. I see music, I buy it.
Yeah.
You know, and so the internet has connected me with all kinds of cool Japanese noise music and avant music from all over the world, crazy instrumental stuff that I love that I never would have found out, or, you know, maybe not. Maybe I would have found out someday.
Right.
But the internet, I think, has been great for music.
Yeah.
And if you're some small band, you can make your Bandcamp page and screw it. Let people listen for free.
Yeah.
You know, you just put up your demo, and people can write in like, dude, good sounding thing, but you got to put your vocals more up in the mix. If that mix is sitting on your laptop, fix it. Repost it. And one day, you know, hell, make a CDR, put it out, or make a 45. It makes music possible. And to me, it's kind of like punk rock, in that punk rock made many of us conclude that music was a possibility, that you didn't have to be Mozart, that you could just be, you know, some angry young man, if you will.
Right.
The internet allows, you know, the mediocre and the awful and the great all to post their content. And I get people writing me all the time, dude, check out my band, and, you know, it's not good. And it's biggest crime. It's just kind of mediocre. And they always want an evaluation. Dude, write me back and tell me what you think. I will not. I refuse to put some guy and his band down. No way.
Right.
Like, if you're in your garage and you're banging it out, you're not going to hear, that sucks for me. Because first of all, I don't think your band sucks. I just think maybe I've heard it before. Or maybe, you have a Tool record. I got it. Or up, yep, you're a Marilyn Manson fan. I mean, you can sometimes, you know, if they're young, they're kind of aping what they got on their record collection. Why wouldn't you? But you can't write the guy back and say, you sound like your record collection, never write me again. You just have to find something good about it. Because I just am happy the guy has picked up a guitar and not a rifle. You know, he's going to rock out. He's not going to rob a liquor store. I think we're evolving. So always just find something good to say. Like, yeah, it sounds like you guys are rocking. Yeah. Sounds like you're having a good time. You know, keep jamming. So I think the internet and the possibility of getting your music heard, even if like all 30 followers here that your Facebook page has or whatever, you can tell I don't know how Facebook works, but it gives you some wind under your wings to make you pursue something artistic, rather than thinking, oh, it couldn't be me. I mean, what if Jimi Hendrix thought that? It couldn't be me. We'd be robbed of, you know, some really essential music.
Exactly.
And so the idea that, and so many of these bands I've discovered on the internet, I end up playing them on my radio show. I mean, they become big parts of my musical listening. And so I think that maybe that might be one of the best things the internet ever gave us, was access, easy access to all kinds of art, be it video or music. I mean, I've seen stuff that I laughed until I nearly passed out on the internet. Yeah. You know, some comedian, you know, doing a thing into his, you know, into his cell phone or something. You know, you just piss yourself laughing. And so I think the internet has been more good than bad. The downsides are very down. You know, kids killing themselves after being ganged up upon on Facebook or whatever. That's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of good things, you know, about all of that. And I see it with the music because I'm literally online about 7 days a week looking for music.
You do the spoken word lectures and things. What can people expect at those who have not gotten to see this but want to come out and see this? What can they expect from that, Henry?
They're long. Your bladder will become a great matter of interest. You will want a restroom more than you'll ever want to hear me again. There's no break. It's about 2.5 hours. It's relentless. I do not take a sip of water on stage. I use a stopwatch so I don't keep you too long. After 2 hours, I start trying to land a jumbo jet of talk. Uh-huh. I talk at a high rate of speed with no notes about everything in that, where I just came from, what I just did, if I think it's a good story. Basically, it's anecdotal and editorial. You'll definitely know what I think about this, this, or that, and I'll tell you all about the last time I was in North Korea. And that's why I travel. One of the reasons I travel to all the places I do is so I can come back to you, my beloved audience, with a great story of the big fish that actually didn't get away. And I just came back from a month in Central Asia, you know, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, places like that, for the experience, for the photo op, you know, to take photos, see things, and for stories I can bring to the stage. And I travel all over the world in search of interesting stories, from here to Iran, Afghanistan, all over Africa, the Middle East, Southeast Asia, Central Asia. I go everywhere looking to come back with something that I didn't know before, so I can tell you when you come to the show.
I want to say thank you for all your music that you've done with Black Flag, plus the Rollins Band, plus your lectures, your books, things that you've done to stay positive for everybody. Thank you as a fan, man.
Oh, no problem. No problem at all.
How can people stay in touch with you? How can they find out where you're going to be doing your lectures, buy your merch, things like that? How can you do that, Henry?
Well, it's very simple, and I'm not encouraging anyone to do this, but henryrollins.com is how you find me. The only shameless plug I'll ever do for myself, since you can listen for free, I beg people to listen to my radio show. It's free. Won't cost you anything. And I think more people who listen to my radio show, the better the world will be. And so you can find all that info on henryrollins.com on my website.
Henry, before I let you go, will you care to do a promo for my show?
No problem.
Just say, this is Henry Rollins, and you're listening to Bod's Mayhem Hour.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Henry Rollins, and I urge you to listen to Bod's Mayhem Hour. May the mayhem never stop.
Everybody, stick around. We got some music coming up, and you only hear these interviews right here on Bod's Mayhem Hour and Uber City Radio. I want to thank the mighty Mr. Henry Rollins for being on the show. Thank you so much, Henry.
No problem, man. Thanks for having me.